You know, I don't know, because I was looking at some gloves the other day. I've been looking at buying a new pair, and like I need a new pair, I know. and I was just looking, like they've got like this cross section, and even in the cross section, you can see that the hand's not in the right shape to throw a fist. It's like this, like standardized now is like that's what a boxing fist looks like. I don't know. It's just I would always want to be able to make a proper fist, and you can never do it in a boxing glove. It always pulls your knuckles out to the side. Like you see it sometimes. Like we recorded the War Room yesterday for Buntan and Sundell. Mm. You can see both of them when they're throwing punches because they've only just started wearing the small gloves. Their thumbs aren't in the right place. Right. Like sometimes Buntan, when she's throwing a left hook, her thumb is up like this, like it would be in a big glove. Mm. Like, I don't know. I think this is why boxers break their hands all the time, because the gloves don't allow them to put their hand in a position that they're supposed to be able to form as a fist. Like, that's a natural thing to do. Like chimpanzees do that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a natural thing to do. That's not a natural position to hold your hand in to strike somebody. And boxing gloves hold your hand in that position, and then they bind it into that position with the wraps. Just don't make any sense to me. Maybe it makes sense for boxing, but it doesn't make sense for MMA fighters to be wearing gloves like that, because they won't train your hands to be in the right position.
Yeah, yeah. Is it? I suppose it wouldn't condition your hands either, would it?
Well, that's so it. I mean, although on the other side, the thing is, like, gloves don't allow you to do much conditioning with your hands anyway. But for the first like 10 years when I was training, we were hitting punch bags and pads and stuff, but we didn't use gloves because we didn't wear them to fight. Like we had, like the full contact taekwondo was full contact kicks to the body and the head, and full contact punches to the body. You couldn't punch to the head, so we didn't wear gloves. So like all of the punching was to a body armor, which was like an inch thick piece of foam.
Yeah.
So you could just wail on them, but if you weren't conditioned and you didn't have strong wrists, like you'd end up hurting yourself. So like I think naturally, like I just got conditioned and then started wearing gloves, and that's why I've realized that gloves don't really fit like a proper fist very well. Yeah. But, you know, like if you think a boxer, they start with wraps and gloves before they do anything. Yeah, yeah. They would never hit a bag without gloves on. It seems like a weird concept, but I don't know. There's definitely something to it. I reckon like push-ups on knuckles as well for wrists.
Mm.
I see a lot of guys with wrists that don't stay straight with their forearms when they're punching.
Yeah, I've noticed my wrist weakness carrying those cameras around.
Richie said the same thing. Yeah, he said the same thing. You need to get some sandbags, man. Hold them in the same positions. Yeah. Anyway, that was a mad tangent. Hello, everybody. Oh, jeez. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Outlaw Picks podcast. Well, we're going to chat about 273, which was a banging card. And we're also going to talk about this weekend's card. We're going to go through it bottom to top. Headlined by Vicente Luque against Bilal Muhammad. We've also done a war room on that, so make sure you check that out. Quick shout out to our sponsors. First of all, we have some new friends on board. Canacarts, these, and that one's yours, Jamie.
Nice.
So you've got to check these out. So it's canacarts.uk. That's their website. That's their Instagram handle. This is premium quality CBD oil. They've got a QR code on the back. He was showing me. He came to the gym yesterday to drop some stuff off. He showed me the QR code on the back. So you scan it and it takes you through to like all of the research data.
Oh,
like
nice.
All of the amounts of everything that's in it. The other thing I really like about these as well is that they're ceramic, and a lot of these things are made out of like plastic and metal. The whole thing's ceramic, so your oil is always, you know, properly protected. That one's yours, Jamie. That is gelato, and it is delicious. And that comes, it's got the charger in it as well.
Wicked.
So basically, you take the cartridge out, you screw it to the thingy, and it'll already be charged.
I like their packaging and
the
branding as well. It's really nice.
It's delicious. I got the gelato, I got lemon, and then another one, Skittles as well.
Ooh.
They're brilliant. They're just so, it's just such a smooth.
You know,
I've tried a few of these and some of them are a bit rough and like they're a bit, but this is delicious.
I like the, you know, the QR code where, it's like, you know, in Vegas and stuff, when you go to the shops, and they've got all the information there for you, so it breaks it down exactly what benefits and stuff you get out of it.
Whatnot. Yeah, he is on point with his research. So it's free shipping within the UK, not for international customers, unfortunately, at the moment. But it's free shipping within the UK. If you use the code OutlawCBD, you'll get £5 off your order. Get on it. I mean, CBD. We've started a sponsorship for the team as well, so the guys will be able to use them after training for recovery.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's amazing to think, like, I mean, I'm a generation before the internet, so like, to think that CBD is like so widely spread and so like so popular for recovery now, and a few years ago we didn't even have a concept of it. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's mad.
It's crazy.
Because I started getting my dad on it for like, because he has arthritis, and I know it's good for like swelling around your joints and just that general feeling better, I guess, if you've got something like that. And it helps him sleep as well.
Yeah. It is. It's amazing stuff. Yeah. I mean, I'm the same. Like sometimes on a cold day, like my knuckles will ache a little bit and stuff. Knuckles and wrists. Right?
Ooh.
Yeah.
It's tasty.
I know, right? We're going to do the whole podcast in a cloud of CBD, babe. So check them out. Canacarts.uk. Give them a follow on Instagram. Get on the website and place an order and use the code OutlawCBD, and that will give you £5 off. Free shipping in the UK. Get on it. And of course, I mean, not really a sponsor, but, you know, of course, Full Reptile, we have a drop this Sunday, and this is the new boxing design that's coming out. So we've got these heather grey t-shirts with the big print on the back. Oh, it's beautiful. And it's not printing on the surface as well. It's treated, so it's printed into the fabric. We've got these. We've got baseball shirts coming out. We've got two types of hoodies. We've got regular hoodies, and then we've got like a hooded t-shirt coming out, which I'll be able to show you next week. But they'll be released on Sunday, so make sure you look out for that. We've also got beanies and hats to match. In fact, I bet you could probably just drop a couple of photos on the screen,
for sure.
Couldn't you? All right, we'll sort that out for you. But make sure you check that out. Fullreptile.co.uk. I believe the code is Dan Said So still. So make sure you use that. Dan Said So, and that'll give you 10% off your order. All right. Talk to me about 273, Jamie.
No, 273.
What's your fight of the night? What's your pick of the night? Performance of the night? Who were you most impressed with?
Of the night? I thought Ian Garry looked really good.
He did.
Yeah.
He did.
He stood out, and he just looked really focused and really like professional, I guess. Yeah. You know, he just delivered and didn't seem to have any trouble with his opponent. Mm. And he looked really impressive, I thought.
That's exactly what I wanted to see from him. And did you see how he was in the corner as well with his coaches?
Mm.
He was like the perfect student. He was like eyes open, listening, responding, yes sir, got it, yes sir, yes sir. You know what I mean? It was it was very interactive and conversational, but you can see how much trust he's got in his coaches. Mm-hmm. And you can tell how well it worked. You know, it was a good performance. You know, Darian Weeks is, you know, he's a tough, durable individual, the kind of guy that you want to test someone like Ian Garry at this point. I'm interested to see what they do with him, because I think his eyes are, he's going to be making headway very, very quickly. And I think the UFC might be smart and just hold him back a little bit.
Yeah.
I think he's got a couple of years to kind of grow, a bit like they're doing with Sean O'Malley.
You know what I mean?
He's calling for all the big fights, but the UFC are smart enough to not put him in there right now because he's just not quite ready. Not that he won't be ready at some point in the next couple of years, but yeah, I'm excited for him. I thought it was a very, very strong performance.
Yeah, it's a very mature performance for a young guy, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about Chimaev?
Oh, man. Great fight.
Were you? I was sitting on the cage as Burns was walking out. Brilliant.
That is so,
it's so iconic. Isn't
it? That was wicked. But yeah, I think everyone was a little bit surprised by Gilbert. Not really surprised. Like, you can't really not, because he's number two ranked welterweight in the world. Yeah. Like, you know, he obviously going to put in a good performance.
I'll be honest, I underestimated him.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like I said on the podcast last week and on the War Room and stuff, like, I honestly expected Chimaev to be able to just boss him around. And it's not that, you know, I don't think I've overestimated Chimaev. I think I underestimated Burns, you know. I think we all look at him and go, well, he was a lightweight. You know, and I think we've always got that caveat in our mind that he's not quite going to be able to compete with the top couple of guys because of that fact. But he can bang.
Yeah,
he
can bang. Super, super tough.
Yeah.
And he didn't, I mean, he was short a bit. I thought Chimaev looked, obviously he's taller fighter, but he looked a bit skinnier.
He looked a bit narrow, didn't he?
Yeah, I thought that. Yeah.
But Burns is just so kind of, he's just so spread and wide, isn't he? He's like fucking thick, and he comes with these big, massive right hooks. I was surprised how well Chimaev took those shots as well. And Andreas Michael was going mad in the corner. Did you hear him? Like, I don't even speak the same language and understand what he was saying, but I knew what he was saying because of what Chimaev was doing and what he knew he shouldn't be doing with Burns. He's don't brawl with him. Don't make it a street fight, you know? Because like Chimaev does have nice in and out movement, and he is very good at managing that distance. But you step into range with Burns, and especially if he's backed up against the fence, he's not going to stand there and cover up. He's going to throw back. So you need to kind of like get him to throw those punches before you commit.
Was he telling him to take him down then, basically?
Like, just stop brawling with him. Stop being reckless. Like, I don't really think he was concerned with how Chimaev approached the fight, whether he decided he wanted to strike or grapple with him. I just think he wants to not be so reckless with it, because they're the kind of fights where Burns wins. You know, he's very good, but then, you know, his punching power is impressive. He was able to crack Chimaev with a few shots. Although, did you see the camera shot from behind Burns?
No, you said earlier. I didn't see it.
So you can see him cracking with that right hand, and then right afterwards they come together and they clash heads, and that's the point where Chimaev goes down.
Right.
I'm not saying he wasn't hurt, but there was definitely a clash of heads there that led to that. But I mean, it was a hell of a fight.
Yeah.
It was a hell of a fight. And have you seen Chimaev's up in the rankings already? Was it number three
now? Number three already.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, there are a few fighters below him, a couple individuals particularly that should be calling for, hang on a minute, why has he jumped so far ahead of us? And, you know, at least one of us deserves a shot.
Yeah.
Like, I'd like to see Chimaev against Sean Brady now.
Mm.
Like, I know they're both kind of like undefeated prospects on the way up, but, you know, they're both top 10 in the UFC now. I'd like to see those two fight one another. And I think I have more faith in Brady having a better time with Chimaev than I did before the Burns fight.
Yeah, yeah. It's the thing that, well, it was in the interview post-fight conference, and people were commenting on like that Chimaev had shown like weaknesses, and but he was bound to have that fight at some point. Like, he's bound, you can't go all the way and not be tested.
No,
I mean, you could, but like, that's very unrealistic.
Especially if you're willing to stand and trade with somebody.
Yeah,
you know, like I would imagine that if Chimaev was less willing to scrap, There would be a much easier way for him to beat a lot of these fighters, but it wouldn't nearly be as interesting, you know. I mean, the things like what he's done to his previous three opponents, you know, the two guys, John Phillips and Rhys McKee, like taking them down and mauling them in such a one-sided performance is exciting to watch. But you would imagine he can do that to the majority of people.
Yeah.
I wonder if he was deterred by the fact that Gilbert Burns, you know, does have good jiu-jitsu, and or whether he just wanted to brawl. You know, I mean, he has been training with Darren Till, and Darren Till loves to trade, and they must have gravitated towards one another for some reason. And I can't imagine it's because Darren Till wants to learn how to wrestle like Chimaev. You know,
yeah,
it's because
sure.
Chimaev likes the attitude and the brashness of Darren Till, and he wants to learn his striking skills.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, smart move. And Hamzat, even in his post fight, he was aware of the mistakes he made. It wasn't like he was like, I just rushed in. I wanted to brawl him.
Yeah. I'm still a big fan. But I was very, very impressed with Gilbert Burns.
Yeah.
Like, you just can't count that guy out, can you?
Yeah.
You can't. So, Aljo against Peter Yan. So, second, third, fourth, fifth round, clear cut, right?
Yeah.
So, we got that Peter Yan Aljo won the second and third. Mm-hmm. He was on his back for almost the whole time. Then the fourth and fifth, Peter Yan beat the shit out of him pretty much. He dominated. Like, and I will say this before we get into the first round. I would say that the last two rounds of Peter Yan were more impressive to me than the two rounds that Aljo won second and third.
Right, yeah.
Just because of how aggressive and how flowing the fight was. It was more entertaining to watch, and he showed a wider skill set. The first round was a weird one because... So two of the judges scored it for Aljo and one judge scored it for Peter Yan. How did you score it?
Well, I've not yet to watch it again.
Okay.
And I wasn't really paying attention in the first round because I watched it. I didn't watch it live. I watched it Sunday morning.
Right. When you were still rubbing sleep out.
So I was making a coffee and like
yeah,
just doing other stuff. So I didn't really pay much attention to that first round. By the looks...
What was your casual feeling?
My casual feeling was Aljo.
Right, okay.
Weirdly enough.
Because he was landing the better quality shots.
I think so, yeah. And he wasn't... Like you said, Peter was pushing forward and putting the pressure on, but he wasn't really doing much with it.
Yeah.
And by the commentator's reaction as well at the end of the first round, I just automatically thought Aljo won it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do want to watch it again and have a bit
of it. It's definitely worth a watch. Because, to be honest, I mean, it's like, because the last four rounds were so clear cut, like the first round is really the big conversation. And it's, I mean, I think it was quite clear. It was quite clear that Aljo was, he was patient and he was fighting very smart. And he was utilizing the fact that Jan was aggressively trying to walk him down because of how the last fight had gone. Peter Yan in the first fight, that first round, he was kind of coasting. Like, he was cruising, he was playing defensive, he was letting Aljo work. And it was like the script had been flipped and he was the one that was now being aggressive and Aljo was like moving away. And I mean, his kicking game looked really good in the first round. Mm. He kept catching him with really good shots. And then, you know, second and third round, Aljo dominating him, taking his back, was... The problem is that there wasn't a great deal happening in those positions, although you can't not score them for Aljo.
Yeah.
But then, like, Jan coming into the fourth round, it was like he was annoyed and he knew he had to do something significant. But I wonder in his head whether he thought he won the first, because I bet he did. I bet he felt like, because he was pushing forward and Aljo was moving away, and because although he's not acknowledging shots that are landing on him the way that the judges are scoring shots that are landing on him.
Right.
Like he will block a kick and deflect a punch and the judge might see that punch as landing, whereas Jan won't acknowledge it unless it actually hurts him. And he probably really doesn't get hurt at all in that first round. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so it's like
yeah.
his concept yeah. of it, it's always the same coming out of a fight. Like your concept of it's kind of skewed because you only register what is worthy to register for you. But the judges may have seen something very different.
Yeah.
And if it's a close fight, they'll score those kind of the tapping body shots that got through and didn't land on the guard. Whereas Jan might not even comprehend that they landed. It's
I think they'll definitely face each other again at some point.
They've got to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Aljo called out Dillashaw, didn't he?
Yeah.
Pillashaw.
It was front row, fortunately, so they can get that fight set up. It's a good one. It's an interesting one because they've both got that kind of squat, low, like stance switching style.
Mm.
I'd say Aljo's got the advantage with the kicking game and Dillashaw's got the advantage with the boxing. But then where does the wrestling fall?
Yeah.
You know, that's a big question.
I feel a bit bad for Sandhagen though. Because his fight, the Peter Yan fight was a great fight. And I do think Peter Yan won.
Yeah.
But then his fight against Sandhagen Dillashaw, like there was a lot of, don't really know who. Well,
yeah, there was controversy.
Yeah, there was controversy.
Sure.
Yeah, so
yeah. I still think Sandhagen's got time though. The thing is, he's 29, and because of the style that he has, he's not taking like major damage. You know, he's been subbed once. He's never been TKO'd. Who was it that he took? Was it Alcantara when he was in that like awkward armbar triangle thing and he was taking all those hammer fists?
Oh, right, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like generally, he doesn't take a lot of damage. So I think that even though he's 29 now, I think you give him 2 years and he's still in this top five. He's just got one of those styles that I think is long-lasting. I don't know. I don't know. I feel like we're going to see Sandhagen come back around.
Yeah.
I don't think it was quite time for him yet. But I certainly can't count him out. He's still one of my favorites to watch on the whole UFC roster.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's partly because I can see like a modernization in the way that he attacks. It was almost like Dillashaw took it a certain distance and then, well, it's like Dillashaw and Cruz took it a certain distance and then Sandhagen came in and just like pushed it to the next stage. But he's not quite got it yet. We've seen glimpses of it, like against Marlon Moraes, where he kept setting him up with that back kick and then went spinning hook. Yeah. I wouldn't mind seeing Aljo against Peter Yan one more time, to be honest, straight away. But I know it kind of shuts the division down. Aljo against Dillashaw is a good one, though.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And Volkanovski. I don't see Holloway beating him, I'm afraid.
Same.
He just looks so good.
He did. I mean, I think Korean Zombies, obviously that fight was like meant to be the Holloway 3, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, he just looked like leagues above Zombie.
Leagues. Like, it was a good stoppage as well. I tweeted about it as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know, of course we can always get on referees when they do bad stoppages, but that, you know, when they do a good one, we need to acknowledge it as well. Like, that's the kind of decision-making we need. It's like, no more.
Yeah.
He doesn't need to take any more.
It's funny because when they came out for that fourth round, like, Volkanovski was like, are you okay? To Zombie.
Are you sure you want to continue? Yeah. You know what's coming.
But yeah, I thought it was a good stoppage. And yeah, he looked on fire.
Yeah.
And I can't see anyone beating him, really, in that division.
No, I'm just looking at the rankings now. I mean, like, you know, we've got high hopes for Arnold Allen, but I think we need to see some developments in his game before he's ready for a Volkanovski.
Mm.
You know, and Arnold Allen's got a few people above him, you know, Calvin Kattar, Rodriguez, Ortega and Holloway. Chikadze could be an interesting one, but I don't know if he's got the takedown defense to keep Volkanovski off, or at least give him the confidence to release his shots and let him go. And then you look further down, you know, you look at someone like a Movsar Evloev, potentially in the future, if he starts making a bit of noise. Ilya Topuria in top 15. I don't know. It's a kind of a lockdown division for him now. Honestly, the fight I would like to see, I'd like to see Cejudo come back out of retirement and fight Volkanovski. That'd be a really interesting one, because I think that they can, to an extent, cancel each other out skill-wise. And I think although Cejudo is going to be the, you know, slightly smaller in stature, I think he's more than comparable with Volkanovski, who's not a giant, you know what I mean? He's not, what is he, 5'6", Volkanovski, 5'7"?
I think so, yeah, 5'6". Yeah.
And then you're looking at Cejudo, who's maybe 5'4", 5'5", and he's been out for a bit, so he's going to be heavy as well.
Mm.
Like, I think that's an interesting fight to make. We'll see. I did hear Cejudo was getting back in the testing pool, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. The thing is, AJ McKee was... It didn't. And did you see that?
Yeah, that's a good fight. Yeah. That's a good fight.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good fight. I mean, at this point, I still feel like Volkanovski, just pace-wise, pace and variety and depth of his game, I just think he's ahead of all these other featherweights right now.
Do you think he could go down as the... Because he's beat Holloway twice, who is... Mm. And he's beat Aldo as well. So do you think he could be classed as like the best featherweight?
I mean, he's heading in that direction. It's difficult to compare, I think, because for me, and this might be a generational thing, or, you know, I might be, you know, rose-tinted glasses on Aldo, but for me, he'll always be the best featherweight. But that was because of what he was doing as a featherweight when I was coming up, I think.
Right.
You know, like, I was watching him use this Muay Thai skill set just to dominate people. You know, like, people couldn't take him down. They couldn't keep up with him. His speed was unreal. And the other thing as well is he was that transition from WEC to UFC, you know, and it was just such an impressive time to be watching him do what he was doing against all of these other great fighters. I don't know as I can compare. I don't know. It's weird. I mean, as far as what Volkanovski is doing right now, he's achieving more than I would say any other featherweight has before, comparable only to Aldo, but. Again, because they're different generations, I don't know how you would compare. I mean, Aldo at one point was, you know, you look at this run. So let's have a quick look. So his last couple of fights in WEC back in 2009. So featherweight title eliminator against Cub Swanson, knocked him out with a knee in 8 seconds. And the timing on it was unreal. Then next up, he won the featherweight title again off Mike Brown, stopped him with punches in the second round. Then he defended it against Uriah Faber, beaten by unanimous decision. And the swelling and bruising on Faber's leg was like nothing I'd ever... It looked like a massive purple sausage. It was awful. It looked like the eggplant emoji. He came into a show the week after, because we did a show together, and he was on crutches. And he couldn't even get his trousers on. He couldn't even get his legs on over it because it was so swollen. But then you look at his run, like, you know, Manny Gamburian, Mark Hominick, Kenny Florian, Chad Mendes... Frankie Edgar, Korean Zombie, Lamas, Chad Mendes again. Then he lost to McGregor, but then he's back. You know, he's beating Frankie Edgar again. It was a very impressive run. I mean, Volkanovski for me probably is probably the most complete featherweight of all time.
Mm.
But I don't know. I find it hard to compare anybody with Aldo, to be honest. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, the scary thing about Alexander Volkanovski is that he's on what, a 21 fight win streak, and he's nowhere near done.
No,
like you could see him fighting for another 5-10 years, and that's scary.
I think his like training and just his mindset as well is like really like way above a lot of people in that division as well. Just like the work he puts in and the grind he goes through. It's a bit like. I don't know if you saw Burns' strength and conditioning like videos
on the countdown.
Before. Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't think I did.
He was going through hell.
Was he?
Like, yeah. I think he's probably obviously needed to for the Khamzat fight. But yeah, just that level of like, you know, the mindset, really strong mindset. I think Volkanovski's like,
He's a bit Mark. He's a bit Mark Madsen in that way, isn't he? Like, he's like clinical in his approach.
Yeah.
There were some really good fights on the card. Like Madsen looked good. Hernandez looked good. I was very impressed with Hernandez. He kept a pace up right until the point where, you know, I mean, Fremd kind of got into it a little bit, but then Hernandez took over. Pennington and Aspen Ladd needs some footwork. I'm sick of watching her walk in circles. It frustrates the hell out of me.
Yeah.
It's such a basic mistake to be making. And against someone like Raquel Pennington, who's got good boxing and wrestling, she's confident she can keep stepping back and then walking her onto a shot. Stepping back, walk her onto a shot. My performance of the night, though, is Alexei Oleinik. Oh, no, I will mention Julio Arce.
Okay.
He was the first fight of the night, and what a wickedly technical performance that was. Because Santos came out banging, shootbox style. And Arce's footwork and his counter striking was awesome. It's like a case study for the guys at the gym. I need to get them to watch it. But yeah, I mean Oleinik.
Yes, man.
Unreal, isn't he?
44, is he?
Is that right?
44.
Yeah. Unreal. And he's like he's 44, and he's not even he just doesn't care how it hits the floor. Like he would give you his back if that means you would grapple with him because he knows he's going to get a position. And there are so many things that, like, that scarf hold choke there, you're not going to get that in a lighter weight class.
No.
Like, that's a heavyweight choke, that is. Because it's not even really a, like, well, I mean, it's kind of not a choke. Like, to me, a choke is, like, around the neck. Like, something that restricts the airways around the neck. But what he's actually doing is, if you think about it, he's around the back of Van der Aar's head. He's pulling his own chin into his chest. But then he's also putting all of his weight onto his chest as well. So he's forcing him to exhale and then there's no way of inhaling because he's got a heavyweight on top of him. Like, if that was a featherweight fight, Volkanovski would have been wrestled out like a fucking ferret and on your back trying to choke you out.
Yeah.
But as heavyweights, like, because he can, like, lay there and crank and just kind of flatten all his weight onto him, like, I felt bad for Van der Aar because I've been in that position against big dudes before and they just get that wrap on your neck and it just kind of goes... And then you're like,
yeah. Did you see him afterwards? The video afterwards, and them
of him showing the
showing
yeah,
him
yeah,
how
yeah.
to do it.
I was chatting with Jimmy about it because we were going through it. I've called a couple of Oleinik's fights, and I had him demo it on me. And it's like he uses his knuckles behind your windpipe. It's a horrible position. Horrible position. I tell you what, it's similar to. You remember Nick Newell, the guy that fought on the Contender Series with the he's kind of got like a start of an elbow and he's got no forearm.
No.
He's a really good wrestler. He's a great MMA fighter and he got an opportunity on, I think it was the Contender Series.
Right.
But I remember grappling with him back at 10th Planet and he was born with it. I'm not sure exactly what the term is, but he's kind of got, he's got an elbow joint, but then his forearm, he's got nothing below his elbow, but he caught me with this wicked guillotine when I was rolling with him. So he wraps, he would wrap your whole head and like cap your chin. And then he would force his elbow kind of point into your neck and then squeeze it all together. And it was like sometimes, same with Ben Rothwell and his go-go choke, like because of the position that he gets on the chin and then he kind of drops his like stomach onto them. Do you know what I mean? It's like sometimes there's a submission that's specific to a person.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, I think like the shoulders and the build of Oleinik, it just suits that position. He's able to kind of like jigsaw pieces. He fits well together in that way. And the one other thing that I thought was interesting from that video is him driving his chin into their cheek.
Yeah, because he made a point of showing that, didn't he? That part where he drives the chin in.
Yeah. That's a Jimmy Warlord submission all day, that is. He's going to be doing that to people now. Now he's seen that video with Olenek, I'm like, oh, we're going to be seeing these things left, right, and center. But yeah, I love it. He's like a throwback.
Yeah.
You know, he's like from times gone by, Olenek is.
He didn't really, I like how he just got up, like finished the fight, and it's just like leaning on the cage as well. I didn't really like care much for the actual crowd. Yeah.
I was a bit disappointed it didn't get to the end of the first round because I like him laying on his back in the corner with his legs up against the fence. He's good, man. I like him. He's a very, very interesting individual.
Yeah.
And in the post-fight interview, he was like, oh, you know, like how much longer are you going to fight for? And he's like, oh, I don't know, maybe another 5 or 10 years. Like his style's, I mean, it's dangerous when he gets to the big punches, but against most heavyweights, he's just going to do that to them.
Yeah.
Like, that's why I picked him. I just can't pick against him. He's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's impressive. Yeah. Sure.
Right, okay. Let us get into this weekend's card. So, it's quite a big card this
one.
Yeah,
it is a big card. This one moving. I think there's 13 fights now.
Oh, is there?
Because Tapology, they don't have a number 9. It goes 8, 10, 11, 12, 13.
Oh, okay. Yes, it does. Well spotted. Mate, well, Tapology's got a decently full card. I'm not sure what's going on with Wikipedia or the UFC's website.
Yeah.
Like, Wikipedia's got seven fights on it at the moment. Okay, first fight of the night, Alateng Haley against Kevin Kroom. It's a bit of a loser might go home type of fight, I'm afraid.
Oh, you mean cut? Yeah.
Yeah. Alateng Haley, when he, in his first fight in the UFC, was against Danil Batgarel. I remember calling that one, and he was... That was an impressive performance, especially because Batgirl's gone on to do much better things.
Yeah.
That was a good win. Then he beat Ryan Benoit by a split decision. And then, you know, he took Casey Kenney the distance. But the thing that stood out to me in that fight was the body shots he took. Like, you remember that?
Yeah.
The bruising.
Yeah,
and because it was in the arena, there's no sound. You can just hear that constant every time. And he just kept working through it.
He's tough for sure.
Very, very tough. But then on the flip side, you've got Kevin Kroom, who's... He's had a rough time. He came into the UFC, won by guillotine. Was it a short notice against Roosevelt Roberts?
Yeah, it was.
Won by standing guillotine, then failed drug test for marijuana.
Oh, was that it? Mm. Ah, right. Because I was wondering why it was a no contest. Because I thought they might have... but I remember it now. And that the post fight and his next fight.
Yeah.
Sorry, that someone asked him a question about it in the interview. And is that what it was for marijuana?
For marijuana. And the thing is, and it was a short notice fight as well. You know what I mean? It was just...
Yeah.
I felt really bad for him because, that would be his only win in the UFC and it's now a no contest. And then he lost a decision to Caceres and to Kelleher. And I didn't think he looked bad against Kelleher.
No.
I thought it was a competitive fight. It's just Kelleher was just able to make him miss quite a lot. But I don't think that Alateng Haley is going to be that kind of complicated of a fighter. It wouldn't surprise me if we see Kevin Kroom doing a decent job in the striking range because he's got height and reach, and then Haley like tries to level change and grapple and he gets caught in a guillotine.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, Haley gets caught in a guillotine.
Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me at all. I feel like Kevin Kroom's a really awkward opponent for him. And there's no reason for Alateng Haley to think that he can't wrestle because generally he has success in those ranges. I'm just trying to think. He's got a armbar loss back in 2015. It's been a long while since he's been submitted. So it might be a case that he's getting a bit outpointed and he might try and grapple with Kevin Kroom. And that's where Kroom's guillotines come into play.
See, I thought this might go a little bit like the Benoit fight.
Mm.
But I know Kevin Kroom's he's a little bit more like unpredictable in his striking. But I think the toughness of Alateng Haley might... I think it will go to a decision, but I think he'll wear on him further into the fight.
You reckon? Yeah.
Maybe first round, Kevin Kroom.
Yeah.
But then second, third, and then just his toughness. And
you reckon he'll pull it back?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I could see that happening. I mean, the one thing that stood out against with Kroom against Kelleher is that he kept getting caught with that overhand right.
Mm.
Like, and that was a vulnerability, and that's something that Alateng Haley uses. He comes over the top with that right hand into his level changes. So, yeah. But then, you know, Kroon was doing good stuff with his, you know, his calf kicks and his rear knee. Like, and that, and did you see the cut that he opened up on Kelleher with that smash lead elbow? Yeah. I don't know. I feel like there's a few things where Kevin Kroon can catch Haley. Like, definitely he could get outpointed if he's, you know, similar to the Kelleher fight, but I don't know. I'm going with Kevin Kroon. I feel like there's a bit more dynamicness to his game.
Yeah.
And, you know, elbows and rear knees and calf kicks and, you know, guillotine attacks.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Adetang. I just think he's proper tough.
Yeah, he is.
Really, like, durable guy.
Yeah.
And, yeah, unless... I think the only... Like, if Kevin Kroon could finish it, I think that's the only... I don't think he'll win a decision. Mm.
Yeah. Okay, so you're going. So you're being specific. Alateng. You're going Alateng Haley by decision, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm not going to go Kevin Kroon by finish or Alateng.
But... I think Kroon's going to open him with an elbow, hurt him with a knee, and then guillotine him.
Okay,
there we go.
Yeah, I think Alateng's going to beat him over the distance.
Yeah. Okay, where are the as far as matchups go? Kroon must be taller. Oh yeah, he's got a 6-inch height advantage. He's got a 6-inch height advantage. Yeah. And a 7-inch reach advantage. Holy shit, that's massive. Yeah.
Yeah, he's tall. He is like lanky. He's really long, isn't he, Kevin Kroon?
But he's only got 30% takedown defense.
Mm.
That's mainly because he likes to attack submissions, though, isn't it? It should be a good one to open the card. Yeah, I kind of feel bad that one of these guys is most likely going to get released because they're both coming off a couple of losses, aren't they?
Yeah. Well,
Alateng Haley was a loss and a draw, wasn't it?
Yeah, a loss and a draw, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what they're doing at the moment. They like the UFC are just, sometimes they just. Not re-signing people. It's like they're not that they're just letting their contract expire. Like they've just done it with Alex Oliveira.
Geez. Yeah.
Charles Oliveira, imagine. with Alex Oliveira, they've just like let his contract expire and they're not re-signing him. It wouldn't surprise me if we start seeing them filter some of these guys out that are opening the cards. A couple of losses, they just won't re-sign them. And Kroon's had 3 fights now in the UFC. Most likely this is his last fight.
Yeah.
You know,
it's funny. I think you said it once, where you can imagine when someone gets released from the UFC, they just like float away into space, and fade away.
I mean, it's kind of like sometimes people are real stubborn and they'll go back and they'll pick up a few wins. Like Peter Sabota did that.
Mm.
Like went away. I think he got 3 or 4 wins by rear naked choke, and then the UFC re-signed him, and he looked great.
Sometimes like Moreno as well.
Yeah,
Brandon.
Exactly. Yeah, good call. Sometimes it's just a little bit too soon, and you know, they have that benefit of going away. Both of these guys, though, you know, 14-8-2 and 21-14-0, they're, you know, a circle back to the UFC would have to be after something very impressive.
Yeah,
they'd have to go and win a title at like LFA or something, I think. Yeah, okay. Right, Sam Hughes against Estela Nunes. So Sam Hughes is 5-4. And Estela Nunes is 6-2. And Nunes, if you remember, she came over from ONE Championship. She's a very good striker. She does struggle if she gets taken down. A lot of fence grabbing and such.
Yeah, was that in the Conalosi fight?
Yeah.
Yeah. She
was like
struggle.
Hanging on to
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
I think even the referee got counted as a significant strike in there somewhere on that. Slapping her hand on the fence. Yeah. She's a very good fighter. But this could be a similar kind of fight to the Conalosi one.
See, I don't... Because Sam Hughes, she's not won a fight since she's come into the UFC, has she?
No, she hasn't.
And I just think she takes a while to get started in the fight as well. And I think if Estela comes out fat, like real fast pace at the start, I think she might just be able to beat her up.
Just blast her, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like she... Poor old Sam Hughes couldn't get close to Pinheiro without getting launched, could she? Like she was either getting smacked or launched, and then she was getting ground and pounded. Yeah, I'm on the same side, to be honest. I think Nunes is going to be too much for her. I think she was matched up against Conalosi, and I think the UFC expected her to win that fight. You know, after what happened with Conalosi against, was it Angela Hill when she got smashed with those elbows and opened up? I think they expected Nunes' Muay Thai to come through.
Yeah.
And Conalosi was just, you know, she was on her case the whole time.
Yeah, she's got wicked front kicks, though.
Yeah.
I think that might be quite useful against Hughes.
For sure.
Just like right
a little
the
bit
center.
Kind of yeah. Like chin hanging.
Yeah, I think she's just going to pick her off. I think unless Hughes comes out really fast and shoots in straight, tries to get the takedown, but based off what her last 3 fights I can't see it going that way.
A bit too much of a slow start. I mean, you know, you never know. You know, everything's on the line for this last one. She might really go mad and like you say, try and take her down in the get-go. But you've got to think, if you're Nunes, you're not working on anything else specifically other than take down the fence, because she knows she's a good striker. And if she can maintain that range, she's going to beat a lot of these fights in this division.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to Estella Nunes
as
well.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah. Okay. Trey Ogden against Jordan Levitt. So 15-4 for Trey Ogden against 9-1 for Jordan Levitt. And Ogden coming in making his UFC debut, isn't he? He's just coming off a... Did he win the Fury FC title? I think that's what he won in his last fight. Yes, he did. Fury FC 53 against JJ Akanovich. Arm triangled him. That was a really fun fight to watch.
Yeah.
Really, really like slick striking, confidence. Like, you know, his lead leg's very busy. Always doing something with his lead leg. Got this kind of difficult to read style. But then, you know, hits the floor as well. He was very impressive. I think this is a good fight for him, because I feel like he's got enough skills to keep this on the feet, and I don't feel like Levitt's confident enough to, you know, he's just not confident in the striking range. He's got very kind of non-committal striking, you know what I mean? And I feel like Ogden's going to feel like this is a good matchup for him, especially because he's got good sub-defense as well. I mean, Levitt, I definitely feel like he has the advantage on the ground,
yeah,
for sure, but I could see Ogden beating him up everywhere.
That's what I thought. I mean, Levitt, I don't think either of these guys are going to be scared to go if it does go to the ground, though.
No.
Because they're both, I mean, Ogden's got loads of submission finishes. I mean, they're quite, like, quick.
Yes.
Round one, round two finishes, yep, as well.
Rear naked chokes.
Yeah.
Guillotines. So
and I felt, like you said, like, Ogden is a better all-round, like, he's more comfortable on the feet. And Levitt, like, he does back away and he's kind of always looking to shoot and get it to the ground.
Yeah.
I think he looked a little bit better in his last fight against, who was it again? Matt Sales.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
He did.
But even then, he was just always looking for the submission.
Yeah.
And he was kind of, it's not even like, it doesn't really strike with much venom either. He was kind of like padding him on the ground. I know it was used to open up.
Yeah, but his priority is submissions.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
he's not striking to really damage anybody.
No.
And I do feel like that's where Ogden has the advantage.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Levitt, it might end up on the floor and Levitt might end up tangling him up with something wild like that, you know, that inverted triangle. But I don't know. I feel like experience being on Ogden's side, I feel like the fact that he's got a more well-rounded game, and I feel like his striking's more dangerous, that even if he finds himself, even if he finds himself in the guard of Levitt defending arm bars and working ground and pound like he did against Akanovich, I think he can beat him there as well. Jordan Levitt's determination to get a submission, I think, is what will get him in trouble in this fight.
Yeah.
Good fighter, but he's just, and I'd love to see some more some more anger in his shots, some more venom in his shots. Yeah,
I did.
I'm going Trey Ogden.
I picked Levitt.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you see him winning? Sub?
I did. Yeah, I see him going for a submission. But the only really reason why I picked him is because he's got a bit more experience in the UFC at the minute.
Yeah.
And he's gone through the Contender Series and he's had three fights, like a tough fight as well against Poirier's.
Yeah. That was rough though. That's one of the reasons why I could see this Trey Ogden fight not going his way, because of what Poirier's did to him.
Yeah.
Like, for sure. I mean, like the Matt Wyman slam, that was, you know, that's just one of those situations, you know what I mean? Arm triangle in the Contender Series, he's got anacondas and heel hooks and stuff. He's definitely got a very strong submission game, but I feel like if he can't get it there, and I feel like Ogden's going to be able to stop him doing it, then I feel like he struggles. I'm going Ogden. I think Ogden's going to TKO him.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm gonna stick with Levitt.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Monkey King.
I could see Trey Ogden taking his back, but not being able to sub him, but then flattening him out and TKOing him from like a back mount position. I could see that happening. He's had a lot of cancelled bouts.
Who, Levitt?
Ogden has. He had four in a row recently. I bet he's glad to be in the UFC so he can get some regular action. Yeah, no, I'm going Trey Ogden for sure.
Yeah.
I like a confident newcomer. Okay. This next one's going to be really interesting. So Chris Barnett against Martin Bidet. Of course, Chris Barnett being the, what is he, 5'9", 5'10"?
Yeah, 5'9".
Like knocked out Gian Vellante with that spinning kick. Brilliant. But then the guy he's fighting, you know, interestingly, the first thing I thought when I was watching Martin Bidet on the Contender Series is he's got that kind of tucked up side to side bob like Cain Velasquez has, free Cain. And he's like bobbing side to side. And I like the way he moves. I think he could potentially walk Chris Barnett down. Like, because Barnett's kind of, he's kind of reliant on the more flamboyant stuff. You know, he's got decent inside outside low kicks and, you know, decent hand striking. But the way that Bidet just marches people down and the size of the guy, I mean, 5'9 compared to 6'4.
Yeah. I thought the exact same, because Barnett's fight against Ben Rothwell, Rothwell kind of did that to him a little bit, just walked him down and just like made him tired, really. And in the end, he just tapped because he was tired, I think.
yeah. I mean, you've got to think, like, if he's 5'9", he's coming in at the top of the limit, 265. Like, there was a photo that they posted from Premier Gym the other day, and it was two guys that are coming, and they were like, they're determined to lose weight. And I think Rob had put them on a plan, and they'd done this like 3 month plan or whatever. And they were both holding a plate, which was the weight that they'd lost. And like, they'd both lost like 10, 15 kilos. And I'm like, I was looking at the plates in the gym the other day. I'm like, geez, 15 kilos is a fucking lot of weight, especially when it doesn't do anything other than just be weight. You know what I mean? And there's a lot of that hanging on him. Like, if you put him on a DEXA scan, like, what could his frame be? I mean, he's 5'9 with a 75 inch reach, which if you give me that height and reach, I'm going, okay, that's a lightweight.
Yeah, I think that's like
a lightweight. I think you must be taller than 5'9".
I think I'm about 5'9", 5'10".
Oh, yeah. Like, that's the same reach as me. I've got like some 74, 75 inch reach, but I'm 5'11". So he's like, he must have a lot of muscle mass underneath that body fat, but still the body fat must be, what are you talking, 30 kilos?
Yeah.
More? Like, that must be so exhausting to carry that shit around.
Especially if a lot of your style is based on throwing those like flamboyant kicks and stuff, like, imagine how much energy you would be like, you're using doing that. Yeah,
they don't even make cars with spare tires anymore. You know what I mean? Like, heavyweights aren't meant to have them either these days. Like, that's what we're learning, is that there's a limit to how far you can go based on your physical conditioning. I'm not saying Chris Barnett can't be an effective heavyweight, but there's definitely weight that he's carrying that's not going to be a benefit to him, you know, in a 3-round fight, let alone 5-round fights.
Mm.
You know, like, we saw it with Roy Nelson. Like, honestly, like, Roy Nelson was a skilled fighter. He was a good wrestler, good black belt. He had decent striking as well, although he became a bit kind of predictable towards the end of his game. But like, when I was doing like those old Inside the Octagons, when we were breaking down heavyweights and stuff, like, he was a punch bag in most of them. Every time you're breaking down Stipe Miocic or one of the other top heavyweights, like, Roy Nelson is the tired punch bag that keeps walking towards them. You know, he just wasn't able to reach those top heavyweights. And I think with the sport in the modern day now,
yeah,
like, he's going to be massively limited in you know, when he gets anywhere near a decent fighter.
I can't imagine him against like Volkov,
right?
Or like Aspinall, Gann.
That'd be unfair.
Yeah,
like, you get prosecuted for making that fight. Yeah. I like the guy. I think he's a lot of fun. Yeah. I think he's a lot of fun. And you know, there's no reason why he can't cause Martin Bidet some problems. But at 6'4", with the way that he fights, nice and tight and tucked up, and he might just be able to absorb whatever Chris Barnett can throw at him. Yeah. He'll exhaust himself trying.
I liked how, was it against Wood, he fought in his Contender fight, that Bidet?
Yeah.
Hood.
I remembered it because it was Hood Bidet, so it was across the bottom. That was the two last names. All right.
Yeah, yeah. He was smashing his like inner thigh with those knees. So if he can like walk him down and just take away his legs, then he ain't gonna be able to throw those kicks anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got Martin Bidet.
Yeah, Bidet.
Yeah, okay. Right. Now, this next one's a weird one. So you've got Rafa Garcia against Jesse Ronson. So Rafa Garcia is 13-2, started his career as a featherweight, moved up to lightweight. When was it? Moved up to lightweight in 2018, and now this is his first fight at 170 pounds. Jesse Ronson, on the flip side, has been he's been like an MMA fighter that's been well known on the outside circuit, and he's been, you know, he's had good fights, good performances. He just never quite was at that UFC level. He got a short notice fight against Dalby, won by rear naked choke, and then failed a drug test for steroids.
So, that's what it was, yeah.
And he's been out since. And it wasn't any nonsense steroids either. It was like shit that I remember the guys selling to one another in the gym back in the day. Like, I recognize the name of it. I'm like, that's proper steroids. That's proper steroids. So, yeah, I mean, he's been out since July of 2020, which then got me onto another trainer thinking, because he's had 31 fights. This is his 32nd. He's a very active fighter. He's always been active. So this is the longest period of time when he's not been competing. Like, when he turned pro in what, 2018, and he's been fighting multiple times every year since then.
Wow.
And then he made his UFC debut, won, no contest, drug test failure, and then he's been out for nearly 2 years.
Yeah. So do you think he's been trying to work on his, like, the technical side of his game more so in that time, or?
I don't know. I mean, my first thought is because, like, whenever somebody comes into makes their UFC debut and they failed a drug test in their first fight, then my thought to myself is, well, they've most likely been using this for a good portion of their career or all the way through. And when they got called up for a short notice fight, they probably tried to clear their system as quickly as possible and they weren't able to. But he took the fight anyway because it's the UFC and why not? I remember speaking to him in Fight Island and he was just buzzing. He was over the moon for finally making it to the UFC. But he probably wouldn't have got the call up had he not taken that short notice fight against Dalby. I can't remember who Dalby was supposed to fight, but he was matched up against somebody else, I think, and it was like Jesse Ronson stepped in short notice. And he was one of those guys. I mean, he already had 10 losses when he came into the UFC. You know what I mean?
Danny Roberts,
there you go. So it was like an opportunity that he got. And he took it, and I just think it's massively backfired on him. And I don't know where his head's at now, because now the UFC aren't going to keep hold of him, especially, like, he did him a favor taking a short notice fight, but they're not going to do him any favors after failing a drug test, which is why I feel like this is a weird one, because Garcia's moving up a weight class. I mean, the thing is, like, Ronson should probably be a lighter weight. He should probably be down a weight class. I think he has fought at lightweight before. Yeah, he has. He's fought a decent portion of fights at lightweight. But, yeah, I don't know.
I like Rafa.
I do. I just don't know whether he's going to be big enough for this weight class. Like, he's like 5'7", isn't he?
Yeah, because even against
Levy, yeah.
Yeah, he did look... Well, I mean, he's quite, like, thick, but he still looked a little bit undersized against Levy.
Yeah. I mean, he's 5'7" with a 70-inch reach. That's really, really small, especially for now what is welterweight. And Jesse Ronson's 5'10", coming at 170. Now UFC stats has got this as a 155-pound fight. Hang on a minute. No, it's a welterweight on Tapology. So yes, who the fuck knows what's going on? So I'm assuming that Garcia's moving up. See, my first thought when I looked at it is that Ronson's probably gone down a weight class.
Yeah.
Especially if he's been out for 2 years, he's probably come off the gear and, you know, he's...
Lost a bit.
Yeah, lost a bit. You know, he might be in his right weight class now. But that, it just seems like an odd fight to make. It would make more sense for Garcia to stay at lightweight and for Ronson to come down than Garcia moving up and fighting a guy that's coming off a suspension for steroids.
Yeah, especially because he won that fight against Levy as well, didn't he? Won the decision.
Yeah. But he has done that. Like, you go back to when he was a featherweight earlier on in his career, and he was winning fights and then went up a weight class and stayed there.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he just feels like his performance improves the less he cuts weight. It might be that. But as we were just talking about with Chris Barnett, 5'7", you know, you're going to run aground at some point very soon in the welterweight division, especially because it's stacked. I don't know. I think Jesse Ronson might have a few too many skills for him. Like, he's been around for a while, Jesse Ronson has. He's had a lot of fights.
Yeah, I had Ronson.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see him winning a decision. But Garcia's, I think he's going to be tough enough to hang in there with him. There's going to be some good boxing exchanges for sure.
I do like his fight name as well. The Body Snatcher.
The Body Snatcher. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm going Jesse Ronson by decision.
Yeah, same here. I think he might be able to maybe get a submission as well.
You reckon, yeah?
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. See, Garcia's takedown defense and his wrestling was good against Levy.
I think if he catches him, because like against Dalby, he caught him and then he just jumped straight on the finish.
Mm.
Yeah, I could see it going a similar way yeah. to that.
Mm. Well, I mean, he's been out for a while. You don't know how much excitement and pent up, energy he's got.
Yeah.
He might come flying out the corner.
It's really slow. Or it might be the opposite.
Yeah, it might be the opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah. Post your side of Ronson might not be any good. Okay. Dracar Close against Brandon Jenkins.
Oh, I think this is going to be a wicked fight.
I do. Yeah. I agree. I like Dracar Close. I've been very impressed with him in a lot of his fights. I mean, his fight against Bobby Green, who's like notoriously a really difficult guy to deal with on the feet. He was just constantly pressuring, never recklessly. Like he wasn't just like absorbing shots, unnecessarily. If he felt like it was necessary to get out of the way, he would move away, but then immediately pressure back in. And then on the other side with Brandon Jenkins, he's very, very sloppy with his striking. He's all over the place. The benefit is that sometimes he'll throw something at the wall and it'll stick. Like his last fight before he came into the UFC was that switch knee on the PFL.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a wicked, wicked little move there. He's also got a knockout with a spinning elbow as well, or a spinning back fist. So you've got to think that sometimes the chaos works out for him, but 8 times it's not worked out for him.
Yeah, especially against Zhurong, who's like tough as hell.
Yeah.
And he just stands in front and just comes forward. And I feel like Dracar Close is going to do exactly the same thing, maybe even better, a more technical version of that.
For sure.
Because I think he only really made the mistake against Dariush by rushing, getting him hurt, rushing in and then getting clocked himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Brandon Jenkins, I mean, he does look good and he's a little bit like unpredictable, but I just think Dracar's just like way too technical for him and a lot more patient and considered with how he strikes.
He's just a bit too disciplined, I feel, for Brandon Jenkins to really make anything work. There's always that possibility that he's going to throw something wild, and because Dracar Close is kind of there, a lot of the time right in front of him pressuring, he might be able to catch him with one of those flying knees, but I don't know. Dracar Close's striking's on point, I think. I would actually like to see Dracar Close against what's his name? Oh, jeez, his name's just disappeared out of my head. Big square. Drew Dober.
Oh, right, like, yeah.
That would be a banger of a fight,
Great
two
fight.
Short, powerful 155ers,
yeah.
Both with good hands and low kicks.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be a really interesting one.
He's been out because since the Dariush fight, he's not fought since then, is he? So he's been out for over 2 years now.
He was matched 3 times in 2021. Yeah. Matched against Luis Pena, and Close was out due to a corner man having COVID. Then he was matched against Jai Herbert, and Herbert withdrew. And then he was matched against Jeremy Stevens, and Close got injured.
Damn.
So, yeah. I think this is a good fight for him. After watching what he did, and Lando Venata as well is an excellent striker. I mean, what he did to Tony Ferguson was impressive, and both of those guys were, they weren't able to deal with the pace and the consistency of Dracar Close's striking.
Yeah, and I think I feel like he did get unlucky in the Dariush fight because Dariush is tough, I think if he was just a little bit more patient, and he did have him hurt, he probably could have won it.
Yeah.
But yeah, obviously Dariush is just tough as hell and came back. Yeah. But and that there's like the famous reaction from the commentators, like the famous meme from that fight as well. Cormier's like losing his mind. But yeah, it's good fight.
Yeah, yeah. And like the other thing as well is Dracar Close. He's had 14 fights. He's still early in his career, especially as a lightweight. This is a deep division. Like, a lot of the guys he's fighting have got considerable experience. You know, Bobby Green, 24-8 was when he fought him. 17-7 for Yagos. 17-4 for Benil Dariush. Like, now he's fighting Brandon Jenkins, who's 15-8. You know, he's always fighting guys that have got more experience. I think there's still time for Drakkar Close. I think he might be in a similar kind of situation to Corey Sandhagen, where we'll see him, you know, doing a second lap in a few years and looking strong.
Yeah, I got Drakkar in that one.
Okay, this next one is, well, this first of all, there's going to be a lot of blood in this next one. Pani Kianzad against Lena Landsberg.
Yeah,
this is going to be a great Muay Thai based fight. I think we might see more grappling from Landsberg in this one, if anything. But both of these are great strikers, really, really strong strikers. Good Muay Thai. Both got good elbows and knees. Maybe give the advantage to Landsberg grappling.
Yeah, I think Pani's like wicked. Mm. I like watching Pani. Really good jab.
Yeah,
like, she throws like one, two, like three jabs at a time, and like just her striking is like really clean, really technical.
Mm.
I do think, like you said, Lena's a little bit stronger in the clinch.
Yeah.
But I think if she can avoid that and just keep the distance between them both, then I think Pani might just be able to beat her in the striking.
Mm. Like Landsberg, I think she's, I mean, the jab of Kianzag is going to be a problem for her. I think Landsberg, even if she is going to strike in this fight, she's going to want to be at a very close range. Because Kianzad on the outside, picking at her and moving and chopping and moving is, I think she's going to seem like the faster fighter. I think Landsberg, even if she does want to work a striking range, it's going to be that close range, elbows and knees and, you know, hard chopping, low kicks and body shots. But yeah, I expect Landsberg to be grappling in this one. If she can get top position and start landing elbows. Was it Tonya Evinger? She grounded and grappled. I think it was.
Yeah,
And Macy Chasson, she did it to Chasson,
yeah,
as well.
Like a win over Chasson is pretty impressive.
Yeah, who's long and tall, yeah, and has got a good jab. Yeah, this is a hard one to pick. Like I've not made my mind up on this one, to be honest. The other ones I was like, okay, this one, that one.
Yeah,
I'm leaning slightly towards Kianzad because I just feel like she's going to be a little bit sharper and more determined. She's got a higher striking output, a higher accuracy as well. 77% takedown defense as well for Pani Kianzad. They're both the same height. Kianzad's got an inch in reach. And she's got the experience as well.
Lena's been out for a couple of years as well, hasn't she? She hasn't fought since January 2020.
Yeah, 2020.
And that was a loss as well. But
whereas Kianzad was that unanimous decision loss to Raquel Pennington in 2021, September. So they've both been out for a little while.
Yeah.
But then Raquel Pennington looked really good in the last fight as well. So there's no, you know. And look at the wins that she's got as well since Pani's been in the UFC. Jessica Rose Clark, Betch Kohea, Sajara Eubanks and Alexis Davis. None of them are really easy fights. I'm ticking Kianzad.
Yeah, I got Pani as well.
Yeah. I think it's going to be a really good back and forth fight. Might steal the show. And I think it's going to be a bloody one as well.
Yeah.
But I think Kianzad's going to take a decision. Sweet. Okay. Where are we next? Oh, and another one. So Devin Clark against William Knight. Two guys. So this is heavyweight, this is listed as.
Oh, right. Yeah. I didn't notice that.
So Devin Clark has, to me, always looked like he was a little bit undersized for light heavyweight. But because he was so heavily muscled, especially his legs, he's got fucking massive legs. Because he's so heavily muscled, he's just not able to get down a weight class. And then William Knight is in a similar kind of situation. Like, incredibly powerful, very explosive, like, backflips on the spot. But just, you know, what is he, 5'9"?
Yeah, he's 5'10".
Yeah, that's generous 5'10", that is. That's 5'10" with fucking two pairs of shoes on.
Didn't he miss weight in his last, because was it a short notice against Maxim Grishin?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And he missed weight. So I assume that's probably why he's gone up to heavyweight.
Yeah, although wasn't the Maxim Grishin one at heavyweight as well?
Oh, was it?
See, this is, again, fucking Wikipedia is getting me confused because, UFC Stats has got this one listed as 205.
What, the one?
Oh, no, was it light heavyweight against Maxim Grishin? He has fought at heavyweight, though, hasn't he?
Yeah, because he weighed in 218 pounds.
Jeez.
But yeah, I think his fight before that, I think it was just because it was a short notice fight.
Because
he made weight against Alonzo Menifield.
Yeah,
yeah,
and Fabio Charrant.
Yeah,
that was a banger of a left hook. I want to like Devin Clark's fights, but I just struggle because I just don't feel like he wants to be in there.
Yeah,
like his dad in the corner seems like he wants to be in there more than Devin Clark does. He's going fucking mental in the corner. But like you just see Devin Clark kind of fold and break. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
he just doesn't. He seems like a guy that's a great athlete and a strong wrestler that just can't deal with the idea of taking punches.
Yeah, I thought this because what fight did I watch him early and he throws strikes, but as he's throwing with always the intention to shoot in and grapple.
Yeah, like, he falls into his takedowns.
Yeah, there's never like just stand back, throw, and then make the opponent faint and then go for a takedown or anything. There's no, he just always seems to like fall into just grappling.
Yeah, like his fight, even when he wins, they're not wildly exciting. Like he's beating people by decision or he's getting stopped.
Yeah, that because when I was looking at his record, like really, he's only lost against like the top guys in the division, but then his, like you said, his victories are only decisions. He's not finished anyone since he's been in the UFC.
No.
And I just think that William Knight's a bit more, he's very like patient. He'll kind of wait for it to come to him. And I think he will just like,
he's going to pick him off.
Yeah.
I think if William Knight lands two hard low kicks at the start of the first round, he'll win the fight.
Yeah.
I think Devin Clark will be like, oh no. This is horrible. This is no good at all. I was expecting this heavyweight to be slower. I wonder why he's going up to heavyweight, though. Seems like an odd call. I mean, he's listed on UFC stats as 6 foot. I don't think he's that tall.
Who, William Knight?
No, Devin Clark.
Oh, Devin Clark.
I reckon both of these guys. I'd say Devin Clark's 5'11 and William Knight's like 5'9. I'd take an inch off both of their heights. William Knight's 73-inch reach, so Devin Clark's got a slight reach advantage of 2 inches. But I don't know. I mean, I think Devin Clark's going to try and wrestle him. He's going to try and hold him against the fence. He's going to try and take him down. Like William Knight's takedown offense is 45%. Devin Clark's takedown accuracy is 34%. He exhausts himself trying, but because there's some panic associated with it, he's exhausting it. He's like trying harder than he needs to because he doesn't want to strike.
Yeah.
And I think, like I said, like two hard low kicks from William Knight and he'll realize the power that Knight's got and you just won't want to be in there.
Yeah, I think like Grishin kind of showed like the way to beat William Knight.
Yeah,
just really pick him off from a distance, just wear him down. But I don't think Devin's got that kind of striking.
No chance.
Level, well, skill.
I don't think he wants to. I don't think he would want to do that. I just don't. He just doesn't have a fighter instinct. Like, you know, good competitor for sure, but not doesn't have a fighter instinct. Anytime someone starts throwing heavy at him, you remember, like, Jan Rinnick, he choked him standing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that's not something that happened. Like, if you've got hustle, you hustle out of those positions.
Mm.
Yeah. I think William Knight.
Same here.
I think William Knight by low kicks. There we go. That's a prediction for you. Okay. Main card starter. Pat Sabatini against TJ Laramie. Now, forgive me, I wasn't madly impressed with TJ Laramie. I haven't been yet. Pat Sabatini, for me, has got good enough grappling skills to, I reckon, get a submission here.
Yeah, same.
You reckon?
Yeah, but I put Sabatini by submission.
You reckon, yeah. I mean, he's got good enough wrestling to compete with Laramie. Like Laramie's got decent submission defense. Like we saw that against Swain on the Contender Series when he was ground and pounding from guard and defending arm bars and stuff. But I don't know. I mean, watching that heel hook exchange with the Sabatini and Jamal Emmers.
Oh yeah, I think he tear his knee in that? Yeah.
Yeah. And they were going until someone got damaged. Unfortunately for Emmers, he was going toe hold, and it's going to be very difficult to finish a fight with toe hold. Like most people are either too tough or too flexible, and it's one or the other. Like, you couldn't bend my foot in that fucking position. Like, it just wouldn't go because it's like, because I'm old and creaky and, you know, I need to get some CBD for my old arthritis ankles. Yeah, I don't know. I've just not been mad impressed with TJ Laramie yet. Like, I think that, you know, I look down his record and I can see good opponents on his record. Like, he's got a win over a guy called Jimmy Spacuzza, who was one of my old sparring partners in Vegas. And Spacuzza's a, you know, good wrestler, good jiu-jitsu, tough individual, good boxing. He's also got a unanimous decision over Charles Jourdan and TKO as well. Like, good wins, lots of decisions. I wasn't impressed with his submission defense against Derek Minna. I felt like he put himself into that guillotine.
Yeah.
And I feel like Sabatini, again, I'll say it, I think he's got enough submission skills to be able to get a finish here.
Yeah, because even the Jamal Emmers win, he was hurt. Did he get knocked down? He got knocked down, didn't he? And then he got onto the heel hook. So I think even if Laramie hurts him, knocks him down, he's still at the risk of getting submitted. And I think, I don't think Sabatini's going to come out as fast as Derek Minna did.
No.
But I think there's equally just as much of a first round submission finish for sure.
Yeah.
Just a little bit more of a longer process. But
I'm not,
Sabatini, I think.
Yeah, 100%. They're a little bit mirror image in some ways, especially when they're on the feet, they've got kind of a long, low stance. But yeah, I feel like Laramie's not quite got enough of any skill set to take ownership of it. Do you know what I mean? Like he's got decent striking, but he's not a striker. And he's got decent wrestling, but he's not really a wrestler. And he's got decent jiu-jitsu, but he's not really a grappler. It's, you know what I mean? It's like it's like MMA's got to be his thing. He's got to make the fight a very MMA-based fight. But I feel like Sabatini's got him beat in the striking and in the jiu-jitsu, which doesn't really work out well for him, and enough wrestling to be competitive.
Yeah. I mean, Laramie's quite young, isn't he? He's only like 24-ish, is he?
Yeah. 16 fights into his pro career.
He has got a lot of time to... And I 24. Think fighting guys like Sabatini and stuff is good experience for him. And if he can get the win, that'd be amazing. But I just think at this moment in time, he's not really at that level of the rest of these kind of guys anyway.
Yeah. He looks like a shrunk down Ian Garry in his Tapology pictures, Laramie.
There's a few...
It's like he's been left in the dryer for a bit too long. The truth. You see it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think it should be a good performance from Sabatini.
Yeah.
I think we've yet to see his best in the UFC, and I think it might be on its way.
He's on a good streak as well, isn't he?
Mm.
Good streak of wins.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, next one?
Yeah, man. Yeah.
So Myra Bueno Silva against Wu Yanan.
Ooh.
This is a who's going to take a back step first kind of fight, because Myra Bueno Silva is very aggressive, constantly trying to push her opponent back behind a barrage of punches. Wu Yanan is quite happy to take punches and just keep throwing back as well.
Yeah.
Like this might be an absolute scrap. Like, I don't expect either of them to get a finish, to be honest. I think they're both going to take chunks out of one another, but I think it's going to be a real banger.
Yeah. I think it's because they've both got quite a few submissions as well on there.
Yeah, yeah. So Myra Bueno Silva's got arm bars, ninja chokes. Yeah, arm bars and ninja chokes. Mainly arm bars. She's actually coming off an arm bar finish in a grappling event as well. Submission Circus 4.
I think she's got a. I think Yanan Wu has got a bigger output. Like, she's a bit more busy.
Yeah.
The way I saw it going is if she can maintain that, I think she'll probably take a decision.
You reckon? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My concern with Wu Yanan is she gets hit a lot. Like, she gets tagged a lot. She's kind of very upright and she always thinks about striking before moving. So she will be very hittable, and the aggression of Myra Bueno Silva, I feel like she might have a bit more horsepower. She might be able to like bully her a little bit. I mean, how do they match up stat-wise? 5'8 compared to... 5'6. So Wu Yanan's got a slight height advantage. Let me pull it up on UFC stats so I've got it properly in front of me.
Yeah, I mean, by looking at a record as well, Yinan Wu, she, unless she's got him out there within the first round or second round, she's struggled going past that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think if it does go the distance, then Bueno Silva might.
Oh, take... now you're convincing yourself the opposite way. Have you got Yinan? Is that who you
picked? Yeah, I've got Yinan. Yeah. Yeah.
So they're... there's a 2-inch height advantage, but the reach is both 66. Slightly higher striking output for Wu Yinan, as we've said, but she also she's got decent striking defense as well, but not as good as Maya Bueno Silva's. And she's also got 66% takedown defense, has Wu Yinan, so she can avoid this going to the floor and getting armbarred, but. I just feel like this is going to be a slugfest.
Yeah.
I think Bueno Silva, she fights with anger. She fights with venom in her punches, and because Wu Yinan, she can be a little bit pushed onto her back foot, and she doesn't necessarily have the same kind of aggression. Like she's there because she has fun doing it, not because she wants to murder somebody. And I think that's the point of difference.
Yeah.
I feel like you've got two forces coming together, and Bueno Silva's going to have just enough to start pushing Wu Yinan back. Based on the volume and the aggression of her punches.
Yeah.
It's less about the amount that she throws and more about the intention with which she throws them. I think she could get outpointed by Wu, but I think she's going to be able to land big shots,
yeah.
Snap her head back and make it look dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a good fight, that one is.
Yeah. It really is. I think so.
Yeah, I'm going Maya Bueno Silva. I'll take a decision, though, because I think Wu Yinan's incredibly tough.
Yeah, I went Wu Yinan by decision.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. So we're both thinking it's going to go the distance.
Yeah. Then.
Okay. Right. Where are we? So we have got Andre Fiao against Miguel Beza. Now, I was very impressed with Miguel Beza. He was on a good streak, wasn't he? When he like stopped Matt Brown and did the arm triangle to Takashi Sato.
Yeah.
Let me get that right. Yeah. Arm triangle against Takashi Sato. Left hook counter against Matt Brown, which was beautiful right as he came in, caught him. And he was working that front kick to the face as well in that fight, wasn't he? And then Hector Aldana, low kicks and ground and pound finish. His contender series fight was probably the least impressive of his wins in the UFC so far. But then he runs into Ponzinibbio and then Chaos Williams, and he didn't look himself against Chaos Williams. He looked like he was very, very tentative in the early going, like he was backing up and moving around and not nearly as aggressive as he has been before. And then Filiao, I thought he looked really good against Pereira in the first round, and then it just kind of unraveled.
Yeah.
But then you look at his record and he's got a lot of first and a couple of second round stoppages.
Conditioning-wise, not...
Yeah, I think conditioning-wise, but I also think Pereira was landing really good like front kicks to the midsection. Like they were starting to bother him, and I don't know whether that started to affect his output and his conditioning. But like you look at his other fight, I mean, he's got a win over Sekulic on the UAE Warriors. He's got a heel hook James Vick. You know, he's not a good fighter, but it just seems to be he's good up to a point, and then it starts to run out a little bit.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether he will run the show for the first round plus minute or two, and then all of a sudden Beza, if he's still there, he'll start to then take over. Because he seems to struggle in the first round and then starts to pick up after that point.
So I thought Beza looked really good in the first round against Ponzinibbio.
Mm-hmm.
But then he just lost I think Ponzinibbio is just really tough, though.
Yeah.
But... I kind of thought that if Fialho can do what Ponzinibbio did, take a bit of a beating in the first round and then just keep that constant pressure on him, I think he might be able to like turn the tables on him a little bit.
Mm. See, I'm seeing it the opposite way.
Right.
I think Fial is going to come out in the first round and try and push Beza back up against the fence like Chaos Williams did.
Yeah.
I think he's going to try and keep him in that range so he can keep peppering him and try and get a finish in the first. And then I think Beza's going to kind of work through that, maybe land a few good counter shots towards the end of the first. Second round starts and then he'll start to take over. I think because he's coming off two losses and they're the first two losses of his career, I think there's some adjusting that's being, you know, needs to happen. And I think we arrived in the UFC and you look at the guys he's beaten, Aldana, Matt Brown and Takashi Sato. They're no mugs. They're no easy fighters. But then Ponzinibbio is a big step up.
Yeah.
Like, we underestimate Ponzinibbio because he had that time off and then he'd lost to, it was the leech, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But Ponzinibbio is probably a top 10 fighter, you know, regardless. And Chaos Williams is just a heavy puncher with confidence.
Yeah.
Like, he had winning great that. Sub defense and everything. You know, it was it was like end of the first round. He was like on a leg for like 90 seconds attacking it. I thought Chaos looked really good in that fight, but he did get bullied in the first round, and I do think Fiel can do that to him. But then he just loses steam.
Yeah.
Maybe if Baszler can work that shot to the midsection and
because Pereira did do that, didn't he? Yeah. He was like whacking that front kick, and they said in commentary that was probably what was affecting him. He's just like kind of arms, elbows dropped down. Because Pereira did get a bit overwhelmed in that first round with the pressure that he was putting on him.
Mm.
But yeah, I think he seemed
to settle down a bit after the first round. Pereira did, and then he was able to just kind of outwork Filial. And you know, then every time Filial was starting to step forward and he was jamming that kick into the midsection, it's stopping him walking forward. It's discouraging him walking forward, but it's also knocking the wind out of him.
Mm.
So each time it's like a, and you know, yeah. I mean, fighting's exhausting as it is, let alone when somebody's knocking the air out of you.
I can imagine if you're getting constantly hit in that section as well, there's like a build-up of like lactic acid and whatnot.
Yeah,
and
just bruising, blood in the area. Yeah. And the other thing that people don't really, I mean, we talk about it a little bit with like the liver shot, but you don't really consider how shots are affecting the internal organs. Like, you know, like if you hit somebody really hard in the solar plexus, so like right where your sternum comes to an end, it kind of goes soft and you feel where the bottom of your rib cage sweeps out to the sides. If you hit somebody there and you knock the wind out of them, there's a disconnect between their diaphragm and their lungs, because you've basically emptied the lungs without their diaphragm being on board with it. And like that's a good example of how you can affect an internal organ. You're affecting the lungs in that moment. If you hit somebody in the liver, there's like this excruciating kind of pain that runs through the body and you just kind of shut down. Like you just don't know what's being affected with those shots to the midsection. Like we were talking about it on the war room with Smila Sundell.
Mm.
You've got to watch that fight with Bongsak Sitfalek, that's his name. And he's right up against the ropes with his back to the ropes, and Sundell hits him with a shot to the body. And she's wearing 16-ounce gloves, and she fucking wellies this thing into his ribs, and it's just a...
Jeez.
It just drops in the corner. Horrible. Horrible. I think Fiao's going to win the first round. I think he's going to have a really strong first round, and I think Baszler's going to beat him up in the second and maybe sub him.
Yeah. I had Baszler.
Yeah.
I can't go against someone called Caramel Thunder either.
Well, at least he's got a future in porn if he decides to cross over.
Yeah.
I think he's very good. And I think we've seen glimpses of how good he is striking and grappling in the UFC. You know, like when he decided he wanted to take Sato down and sub him, like it was dominant. And I you might be able to do that against Fiao as well, but he's just got to get through that first round where I think he's going to be under pressure. But I'm taking Baszler.
Yeah, he's a black belt, isn't he?
Baszler. Yeah, Baszler. I think so.
Yeah.
Wicked. Okay, co-main event.
Nice.
So, I can never say this guy's name. Kiao Bohayo against Gadzi Amar Gadziev. Gadziev?
Yeah.
We're almost there. This is a really interesting one, because Bohayo doesn't fight the way I expected him to.
No,
he's like side on karate style southpaw. He uses a lot of like lead side kicks, but then he looks like Paulo Costa. I don't get it. Yeah. I don't get it.
He is very Paulo Costa mixed with Charles Oliveira.
There you go. We had the conversation yesterday about MMA love children. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. He does. He's a bit between the two, isn't he?
He's got the glasses of Charles.
He's got some fucking questionable tattoos. Have you seen? He's got fight or die tattooed on his arm there. And then across his neck, I've been trying to figure out, it was distracting while I was researching. He's got free spirit tattooed across his neck.
He's got no tats anywhere else though. I never
get. He's
got
like little ones. He's got like a little one on his ribs. Yeah. And yeah, it's
like
a rib.
The neck tat, especially if you've got no tats anywhere else. Why would you get one on your neck? With your arm or something at least.
Exactly.
You know.
Like my mate always used to call it nerd armor. Like when people get their hands and their neck tattooed first, it's like you know, like it's like you're trying to be a tough guy.
Yeah.
But he is from Fight Nerds, isn't he? That's his
Oh right, okay, yeah.
That's his team. Fighting Nerds. Yeah. It's a really odd one, this one is, because Omar Gadziev is very, very good on the ground. You know, will most likely flatten an opponent out and get a submission. That knee bar finish that he got in the Contender Series was slick. I just don't know. I don't know where Fiao's grappling is. I don't know whether he's going to be able to deal with that takedown offensive. I don't. It's an odd one. This one is because the thing is like Barrio looked good in his last fight, but that was his first fight up at light heavyweight. Like he had a decision against Aaron Jeffrey on the Contender Series. You know, he won it, but there was nothing overwhelming about his performance. And he does have a good bunch of decisions on his record as well. He's got some subs, Reneke chokes, anacondas and guillotines and stuff. But my concern is that because he's got grappling skills, he might not have the takedown defense to stop himself getting put in bottom position.
Yeah.
And then can he utilize his grappling skills when he's underneath Omar Gadziev?
Yeah, he's just got that heavy top pressure as well, hasn't he? And I think it, like, because his Contender fight against Yancy Silva, he was a good striker. And he was just able to, like, avoid that, take him down and just,
Yeah. And he went, was it heel hook to knee bar, wasn't it?
Yeah. I can't really see it going any other way other than Gadziev's just drown him.
Yeah. I mean, I think Bahio's earned himself an opportunity on a UFC card after his win against Jesse Murray in the Contenders. He did look really good there, but then you've got to wonder, is the fact that he was fighting at light heavyweight and not weight cutting, is that where he had the extra little bit of gas from, or did he take that fight on short notice because, you know, they needed someone and he was in the area and he didn't have to cut weight? I mean, because now he's going back down to light to middleweight, and he's not stopped somebody at middleweight since 2019, and I don't think he's going to guillotine this guy.
Yeah, and he's got, like, Gadziev's, like, really strong, like, really powerful guy. I don't think he's going to be able to stop the takedown at all.
No. I'm taking Omar Gadziev.
Yeah, same.
I think he's going to take him down and ground and pound him. I don't even think he's going to try and sub him. I think he's just going to beat him up.
There's, like, loads of these, like, Russian undefeated guys coming through.
Yeah.
It's like they've just got like an army of undefeated fighters.
It's like sometimes when you find your way into a team, it kind of opens up a whole new a whole new kind of, like, almost like a league. You know what I mean? Like, you find a fighter from a particular gym and then all of a sudden they've got two mates that they train with and they fought on these cards and he's only got one loss to this guy, so we'll have a look at his record as well. And he's like 22-0, and like there's a lot of events that go on that go unrecorded as well. Yeah. So, like, you know, gym fights and stuff that they just don't keep a record of those fights. So a lot of these guys fight with an immense amount of experience.
Yeah, he's got quite a large amateur record.
Yeah, what is
by the looks of it?
Yeah. He's had 10 fights as an amateur. Yeah. But again, you know, as we're saying, they're the ones that have been recorded.
Yeah.
Like, how many times has he had fights in gyms and, how many other, like, martial arts has he done? He's probably been competitive. Like Peter Yan's had, you know, 100 or so boxing matches. You know, I bet there's a lot of other experience in Omar Gadziev's history.
Yeah,
29 as well. You know, it's not like he's at the beginning of his career.
Yeah. It's a different. I thought he'd fought Magomedov, but it's a different Magomedov. in his amateur career.
Oh yeah, right down at the bottom. Yeah, yeah. I'm taking Omar Gadziev.
I think he's
just going to be physically too much. I think he's going to take top position and ground and pound finish.
Yeah, same. Yeah. Same.
Okay, main event time. Go on, what's your pick?
Oh, straight off.
Straight off.
Vicente Luque.
Okay.
Yeah.
And why?
Because I think, like, I think from their first fight, I do think Bilal's probably learnt a lot from that. And I don't think he would get caught with that again. I think they've both grown as fighters, for sure, since they first fought. But I just think Vicente's a little bit better than him.
Mm.
I do.
It's just like a little bit better everywhere.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah.
And I think, as well as Bilal learning from that fight and developing as a fighter in the division, like growing into the division, I just think Vicente Luque's done the same thing, but he's fought a higher caliber of opponent.
Yeah.
And now I think Bilal's fighting that caliber of opponent. I don't think he'll win.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I think it'll be more competitive than their first fight. Yeah, that was like a minute 21 to Vicente Luque caught him with that counter hook. That for me was a turning point for Bilal Muhammad. So he's definitely going to be a better fighter coming in. But I would also imagine that's of all the fights on his record and what he's got, three losses, this is the only stoppage loss. I bet he has a lot going on in his mind and his subconscious link to this fight and this opponent. Because it's like, this is my opportunity to get one back. Thinking back to all the differences between who he is now and who he was when he first stepped in there against Luque. Like, I'm always fascinated when it comes to rematches to know where the person's mind is at. And obviously we never do. And sometimes they won't be honest with themselves either. They'll say things that they want to hear themselves say, but they won't believe it.
Mm.
And you just don't know whether Bilal Muhammad looks at Vicente Luque and he's like, I don't want to trade with him. Like, I've gotten better, but that's a power that I can't deal with. Because as we were talking about in the war room, like, Vicente Luque is a finisher. Like, what, 21 wins, he's got two decisions. And Bilal Muhammad's, like, three quarters of his wins go the distance. I feel like Vicente Luque is a little bit further on in his career and a little bit more dangerous everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think because obviously the Wonderboy fight, Bilal Wonderboy has controlled him.
Yeah.
But he only really did that because he knows the threat of Wonderboy on the feet, and that's the best way to beat him. But towards the end of that fight, Bilal was getting a bit tired. And I think Vicente Luque is a bit more of a threat being taken down. He's got dark choke
for
finishes.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so I think if Bilal does decide to take it there, then he's at more risk than he was in the Wonderboy fight.
Absolutely. It's a bit of a, you know, like where do you think, it's like top trumps, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, well, my grappling number's good, my striking number's good, but he could be better at either or both. So which one am I going to go with? Which one do I take a chance on? The thing is, regardless of which direction he goes with it, like, his pace has to be a part of his game plan. Like, he has to work harder than Vicente Luque and do it in a such a smart way so he's not vulnerable to Vicente Luque's power. I feel like his margins for error are narrower on the striking range, and I feel like because he got punished in striking range before, he might choose to want to grapple and play a bit more like he did against Wonderboy. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if we see Vicente Luque defending takedowns against the fence for the first couple of rounds before Bilal Muhammad then starts to look tired and then starts to have to strike. But by this point, he's already spent his energy trying to take him down and has not been successful. And as you said, you know, even if it does hit the floor, we know that Vicente Luque's got good skills. Like, Chiesa took him down, he reversed it, escaped the back, and then darced him. And my only criticism is that his darce chokes aren't the most technical. And I do feel like Bilal Muhammad is a good grappler and he's very aware. So he might be able to either kind of hold out and let Vicente Luque tire himself out trying with a darce, or he might just be able to use that to get top position. Because the darce choke that he used on Chiesa and on Tyron Woodley, although he was kind of cramped up against the fence against Woodley, had that darce choke not worked, had that grip of the hand on the bicep slipped off, he would have not only lost the choke, but he'd have lost top position.
Mm.
Like, think back to when Korean Zombie darced Poirier. He was on top, laying on the side of his head.
Yeah, yeah.
And Vicente Luque is always underneath, trying to pull them into it. So he's not using gravity. I mean, he's obviously got gravity of his arms, but when you're on top, you've got gravity of your whole body, and you're already in a better position to scramble. So I don't want to underestimate Bilal Muhammad, because I do think he's got good grappling, good wrestling, good conditioning. But I do wonder whether I do wonder whether he's prepared for five rounds. Like, he's only been matched once for five rounds. That was Leon, and it didn't, you know, only just got into the second.
Yeah, I feel if he's having to work the takedowns and it's not working from like the first round onwards, I think he's just gonna like I said in the Wonderboy fight in that third round, he got caught a couple of times, but he managed just to get the takedown. But then, you know, in that situation, both guys are tired anyway. But yeah, I think he's got to be really, really good with his management of his energy.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I'm taking Vicente Luque.
Yeah, same.
I think he might get another stoppage, you know.
Yeah.
I think he might stop him again.
I can see it being, if Vicente Luque doesn't finish him, I can see it being a bit of a war, for sure.
Yeah.
I think even if it goes a distance, I think Vicente would probably take the decision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, his shots are going to look more meaningful as well.
Mm.
Like Bilal Muhammad against Lyman Good, that footwork he was using on the outside, like darting across and stinging and switching his stance and stinging, that might work all day against Vicente Luque if he can do it all day. And that's where I don't think he can. And I also think every time he steps in, there's a risk of getting countered. So that's why he might start to grapple. And I think you're right. Like if he feels like he's trying to grapple and he's not being successful and he has to strike, then there's an additional level of panic that comes with that. Yeah. I'm taking Vicente Luque.
Yeah, same sure. Here.
I think he's probably going to stop him like late third, I think.
Yeah.
But I could see him losing the first, like just based on Bilal Muhammad's insistence on wrestling. But...
yeah. I do like how Bilal, like that control he had against Wonderboy, where he's like almost inside, but on his back, and Wonderboy's like up against the fence and he's just...
yeah, and he's just whacking
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. I do like that kind of control he has over... his opponents, but I can't see him doing that against Vicente.
No.
Sure.
No, me neither. No. Right.
Yeah.
Let's get this one wrapped up. All right. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Just a quick shout out to our sponsors, Can of Carts. That is canofcarts.uk. That's their website and their Instagram. Go and find them. Give them a follow. Free shipping in the UK and £5 off your first order if you use Outlaw CBD. It's right on the bottom of the screen, isn't it? Right now where I'm pointing. I hope. I don't know. And obviously, Full Reptile. This is our new shirt that's going live on Sunday. This will be live at 4 p.m. on Sunday. And again, same as the floral hoodies, we have limited numbers. Once they're gone, they're gone. And we're probably not going to restock these because we've got so many other designs in the chamber. So we need to keep this thing rolling. So FullReptile.co.uk, you can use the code Dan Said So, and that will give you 10% off, and Can of Carts Outlaw CBD, and that will give you £5 off and free shipping in the UK. Make sure you check those out and enjoy the fights. Nice one, Jamie.
Take care, man.
All right, nice see one. You next time.